matter what people say. Yeah. We got it going on. Yeah. Who cares about what they did?
You know me. I'm the hottest in this
scene. WJMS. This is According to RP.
Turn up the volume, kick back, and get raw with us.
From the latest hip-hop beats.
Spazzle.
To social issues that cripple the black community. All from the perspective of a young, strong black woman.
A strong black woman.
And now your host, Rita.
Welcome back, everyone, for another episode of According to RP on WJMS Radio, powered by Black Ivy Media. It's your girl, Rita Pierre, your host. And as always, I hope you guys are striving, thriving, and surviving in these corona-infested streets. Now, I know that some of you are dreading the fact that my sultry voice is starting to lose its essence, but that's a sign that I'm doing much better. Compared to last week's episode, I think I am doing much better. My energy level is higher this week, and I'm feeling 10 times better than I did last week. I just wanted to thank you all for sending in your thoughts, your prayers. You know, as much as I'm on this radio station and it sounds like I'm a open out there person, I am a very private person. I'm not the type to broadcast when there are issues going on with me. But I know last week, since I was at the tail end of this Rona situation, I did let you guys know what was going on. And I really appreciate just all of the support that I've gotten from you all. But we're moving forward. And today is Sunday. It's the beginning of a new week. And I just want to take this time to say happy Haitian Flag Day to all of my Haitians out there, to all of my Zoes. Now, Flag Day is actually on Tuesday, May 18th, but the Flag Day celebrations were going on all weekend, especially here in Brooklyn, New York. So I just wanted to take this time to say happy Haitian Flag Day to all of my Haitians, to all of my Zoes out there. And you know, I'm always about the education. So just a quick little history lesson, historical fact with respect to the Haitian flag. So after Toussaint Louverture was captured and died in the French prison in 1803, Dessalines and other leaders took up the mantle and they decided to march on with what is now Port-au-Prince, Haiti. And they wanted to carry a flag that would represent their troops. So on May 18th, 1803, they pieced together a design for the official flag. And since then, May 18th has been known as Haitian Flag Day. Now, the design of the new flag began with the French flag made up of the blue, white, and red bands. The white band was removed to indicate that the French no longer had control over the colony, and a woman by the name of Catherine Flon sewed the new flag together using vertical bands of blue and red cloth. The blue represented blacks and mixed-raced people, and the red symbolized their blood. So over the years, the nation's flag has been modified several times because those of us who are people of history know that the flag used to be black and red at one point. But the flag day itself has remained the same as the day the nation's flag was first sewn together. So May 18th is a major holiday for Haitians all over the world. So today we have a very, very special show with a very special guest by the name of Kinyumba Muta Kabir, who is an actor, documentarian, and so much more. He has a new short film that will be premiering next week, Tuesday, May 25th, entitled Nguvu Kwa Watu, which means power to the people in Swahili. You do not want to miss this conversation on race, inequality, justice, and so much more. So make sure you keep it locked here. But in order to give our guests, you know, ample time, we're not going to go into all of our preliminaries, but we are going to go into a few. So it is now time for the Urban Dictionary word or phrase of the week.
Do you understand the words that are coming out of my mouth?
May I have the definition?
What does skeet skeet mean?
What's on fleek?
Can you use it in a sentence?
I'm on fleek, lit.
And it's gonna be lit.
Major key.
It's time for the Urban Dictionary word or phrase of the week.
So So this week's Urban Dictionary word or phrase of the week is IDGAFWTCDCSYBWYMFM. And this is an abbreviation for I don't give an F what the CDC says you be wearing about your mask. Interesting. Karen says, the CDC says we can stop wearing masks. Frank says, IDGAFWTCDCSYMBWYMF. I'm sorry. The people who create and send in these Urban Dictionary definitions are out of their mind. First of all, nobody is repeating this alphabet just to tell somebody that they don't care about what the CDC says. But apparently, since we are an abbreviation culture, I've noticed even in Texas and in Instagram posts, I actually have to pull out my pen to write down these letters and then figure out like what people are trying to say, because I guess nobody wants to write full sentences anymore or write things out. So maybe some of you guys are already using this these letters to express how you feel about masks and the CDC. So if you are one of those individuals, please slip into the DM at According to RP. Let me know. Are you using this? What do you call this? Like this abbreviation? I don't know. Urban Dictionary gets me each and every time. Either way, we are moving along to our Haitian Creole word or phrase of the week. Haitian Creole word or phrase of the week is drapeau. Drapeau means flag. So since it's Haitian flag weekend, Haitian flag week, I thought it would be appropriate that you guys know how to say flag in Haitian Creole. So again, the word is drapeau. So with a D, drapeau, like Draco, but drapeau. So we are moving on now to the meat of the show. All right, everyone, I'm here with my very special guest, Kinyumba Mukatabari. Did I say it right?
Oh, boy.
Did I say it right?
If saying someone's name was a curse word.
Oh, no.
No.
And, you know, I should have squared that off, but I think I was so confident.
You know, here's the thing. We don't want you people to think that this was all rehearsed, right? So exactly. I appreciate going right in for the juggler, failing gracefully.
Oh, but wow.
Attempting the fail nonetheless, right? You know, at the end of the day, success comes in the attempt. It's Mutaka Bear.
Oh, Mutaka Bear. Okay.
Little phonetic, but the end tends to kind of throw people off because of the two B's.
I see.
Mutagabier is my
I was trying. I think I was trying to create some interesting finesse, and
it was beautiful.
It fell short.
I don't know whose name that was, but that name, the person's name, very beautiful.
If you're out there and this is your name, please let me know.
If this is your name.
Oh man! Well, thank you for being so flexible with it. I understand the name thing, but some people aren't as forgiving, so thank you for being so forgiving.
With a name like mine, you got to have tough skin.
Well, thank you for being part of today's show, being part of this platform. You know, I was reading up on you and looking into some of the work that you've been doing, and I'm like, I'm honored to actually even have this conversation with somebody of your caliber, so thank you.
Yeah, well, the honor is truly mine. And, there's always a platform for this type of conversation as far as I'm concerned, and always time for it. So I'm grateful that you are among those who are that person or that group that are willing to shed light on or have drive conversations on important topics for our culture.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I think with the time period that we're in, like it's a must, right? It's a must. We can't not have these conversations.
And then we have to act too. You know, I think it starts with these conversations for sure. And it allows us to organize, and then we need to participate, and we need to move forward. We need to move the needle forward in our own backyards. So that's thank you for, you know, being the initiation of that, you know, and then we can kind of continue to keep the engine.
So, Kinyumba, you are an actor, you're a documentarian, you're a martial artist, you're a coach, a teacher, a whole bunch of things, right? But I like to get a little deeper with my guests. So if you can just let everybody know, you know, who are you? Like, where are you from?
So, it's interesting, right? I have friends in so many places, they'll always make fun of me and say, you're not from there, you're from here. I was born in New York, and I lived in New York until I was about a teenager, and then moved to Atlanta. So I was raised in both Atlanta and New York. Mm-hmm. I got to see a little bit of both sides of the coin, if you will. I lived in the city. I spent most of my time in South Jamaica, Queens when I was in New York, between Flushing and South Jamaica, Queens, where my father's martial arts school was. You mentioned I was a martial artist. I was born in the dojo. That same block that I was basically teaching martial arts, learning martial arts, becoming, you know, a young adult or a young kid. My brother was murdered, you know, two blocks away. So it's one of those kind of neighborhoods where you just, you know, you never know. Yeah. And you come up with a sword drawn kind of mentality. Mm-hmm. Then I got to go to Georgia and live in Gwinnett County and enjoy suburban life and play football. And I'm, you know, on a football team with cats who have Confederate flags on their trucks and, you know, going to Paley Wigley's and, you know, just a very different lifestyle, almost like a varsity blues kind of mentality. Mm-hmm. And there, you know, I was fighting in a different way. I was fighting for people to say my name correctly or respect me as a Muslim. Things that were very out of the ordinary for, you know, the average Southern white American or even Black American, for that matter. And then from there, you know, I kind of decided to go play football at the next level. And in that realm of time, I decided, let me try doing something else besides banging my head against things to achieve some financial stability. Mm-hmm. I got involved with almost every organization you can in college, including theater, where I found my love for, you know, creating characters, bringing characters to life. And one of the things that I really loved about film was the theatrics of it, because I was already doing that in martial arts. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things, we train a lot in kata, and kata is like a visualization technique of combat. Okay. So you're visualizing, you know, impacts with certain moves and strikes and positions, blocks, and parries, and things of that nature. And so, you know, when you're doing those things, you're visualizing, you're conceptualizing, and you're creating an environment. And that was natural for me when it came to being a part of a play. And, you know, that bug kind of stayed with me as I proceed in other careers. I've always been, you know, kind of a multi-hyphenate ever since high school, you know. And, you know, the kind of rest is history. It's trying to apply, you know, all these different crafts, all these different trades. You know, we live in a technology or information age where we can, you know, acquire so many details and so much data points. And if we're savvy enough and ambitious enough, we can apply them all. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to have great family, great coaching, good mentorship at every level of my life. You know, even if it wasn't positive, it was great because it gave me insight on what not to do at some point. You know, I mentioned before, I experienced death at a very early age, and I experienced life. And, you know, I experienced people who have been extremely successful doing the wrong thing, people who have been extremely successful doing the right thing. So those things also give you like a little bit of a understanding of how to develop as a man, what your legacy would like to be known as, because you start to say, okay, it's not just about money. You know, this person's legacy is tainted, even though he has all this money, because of what he has to do to get to that money. Yeah. And always been important to me not to follow just money or follow some sort of like wealth or material, just the possession, and just more so focus on the cause, focus on the why, focus on the impact that I'll make, and again, the legacy. And so, in a nutshell, that's kind of how I got to all of these things that you mentioned into this one space that I'm in right now.
All right. Yeah, no, I mean, it's very fascinating, you know, just to see how one individual can really be part of all these different things, right? And it goes through that that mantra, that saying that people say that Black people are not a monolith, right? Like we, there's so many different dimensions and layers to who we are and even the things that we do. So I think that just, you know, what you've accomplished so far is definitely like remnant of that.
Well, I would say this, not only are we not a monolith, the last 100 to 400 years don't represent us, mm-hmm. you know, that, or even I would say, you know, 20 to 400 years, you know, I think just now we're starting to kind of find our own voice through like, you know, music and, you know, understanding again, we have access to more information so we can make our opinions of ourselves. Mm-hmm. But I mean, we were programmed. I mean, listen, I'm going to be really frank with you. I don't know about you. And that's one of the things that I'm excited about. We'll talk about this. My new venture is here in Baltimore, where I'm at right now, is to kind of create a different narrative about living in a Black neighborhood. Because that was part of the reason why we moved mm-hmm. to Georgia, was to kind of escape the quote unquote ghetto, right? Yeah. And, you know, that's sad because there's an understanding now, or has been, that we're not, you know, necessarily good to be around, you know? And so not only are we not a monolith, I believe that most of the things that we have been programmed to think about each other is flawed and mm-hmm. is from the perspective of a supremacist.
Yep. Yep. I totally agree with you there. I think that, you know, one of the things that we try to do at Black Ivy is to change the narrative and find the different ways to change the narrative from within. So it's right. not just about right. changing the narrative so that the rest of the world, like the non-people of color, can understand who we are, but so that we ourselves can understand each other and we could become more comfortable with each other so we could move forward.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think what you said is the heal from within. We have to love each other. No one can love us unless we love ourselves.
Exactly. You know? So I want to talk about the documentary that will be premiering on May 25th. And there's a lot of significance, even with the date that you chose to release this. So, you know, I don't want to be the one to talk too much about this, you know, but I want you to kind of talk about this new project. Like, what is this documentary that will be premiering on Tuesday, May 25th?
Well, thank you for the plug and shameless plug, May 25th, Tuesday, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 6 p.m. Pacific Time. Tune in soon. Link will come soon. it's called Nguvu Kuawatu. Now, a lot of people are like, what? And I wanted that reaction. And in fact, I didn't even want to tell you what it meant. I wanted you guys to look it up and, you know, do some research on your own. But it is a Swahili phrase and it means power to the people. Let's just start with that. You know, I have a lot of intentions. Everything I did with this project was intentional. So I chose the name of Nguru Kwawatu because the importance of language, I think, is not emphasized enough, I should say. It's overlooked is the word I'm looking for. You are, I believe, a patient descent. Sapase, sister, I believe,
Nabule,
right?
Nabule, you got that right.
Yeah, right. So now you see how when I say that phrase, how it brings a jubilee to you. It brings a certain sense of pride, right? Nationalism. That's something that we ripped away from African-American people, or, you know, if you want to say ADOS, ASOS, American Survivors of Slavery. We never had that for the past 400 or 500 years. But the point is the language idea was important for me to try to drive some sort of cultural reference back to our, you know, ancestors. And, or even if it's not something that we spoke directly in our genealogy, it comes from a continent. And it's interesting language to conceptualize because it has Swahili in it. I'm sorry, it has Arabic in it. It has English in it. So it has derivatives of the languages that we currently either speak or hear on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it has these references to our, you know, ancestry. A lot of people don't know that my first name is actually Swahili. It means ruler of the house. That's why people call me king, because that's the, you know, the definition of it in mm-hmm. English translation. So the point is that I wanted to drive a narrative of how important language is and how the development of culture, community, customs and mores all come from this, our ability to establish a lexicon. But a lot of people don't know this, but the Hebrew that's spoken today wasn't established until the 1900s. Mm. And what that means is that they took an old archaic language and modernized it so they can incorporate words like ice cream, car, and plane that were in the conversation back in the Old Testament. Right? Mm-hmm. And so as a result, you've seen the growth and the flourish of a culture you know, our brothers, our Jewish brothers and sisters have had by, you know, establishing, you know, a certain spiritual practice, spiritual beliefs in their community and language. And so I think it's important to kind of have these kind of fundamentals in our communities. I'm not saying that we need to go out and learn Swahili, mm-hmm. but we need to have some sort of collaborative understanding of who we are outside of those 400 years that we arrived in this country. And for many of us who are already here on this country before, in this land, before, you know, it was colonized and, you know, dragged on to slave ship or slave plantations. Also moving forward, the concept of the film, just kind of skipping forward besides the title, is based on my experiences in California. So I lived on Melrose before I moved to Baltimore. I was on Melrose, and Melrose between La Brea and Fairfax, where I live, was literally one of the the hotbeds of protest. I mean, mm-hmm. from May 25th till about 4th of July, every day, sometimes two, three times a day, hundreds, if not thousands, of people just marching. I mean, listen, COVID must have passed my house 20 million times. You know what I'm saying? Like, I am bulletproof from COVID, I swear to God. Like, it was nonstop. I mean, I was there when they boarded the doors and windows up, and it hasn't been unboarded really up until maybe like a few months ago. Mm-hmm. So just seeing that and seeing so much of an outpouring of support, a part of me was prideful, but a part of me was also sad because I felt like I didn't know why people were doing it. I wasn't sure if they were doing it because they were bored in the house. I wasn't sure if it was because some people just were really just fed up and they needed a cause to let their anger out. Mm-hmm. You know, people had an enemy, a universal enemy in our president, and wanted to express that. At least people who were choosing to march for this type of civil rights and social justice. And I think, you know, all those things are great causes, but I think overshadowed in all that was the African diaspora, who was ultimately suffering the most by this prejudice, this oppression, this PTSD, these dynamics that are continuously hurting and affecting us from an economical standpoint to just a life work or a life quality of life standpoint. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've gotten to even arguments with police officers on my Instagram about the term systematic racism and how people were just throwing it out the window like it was, you know, some sort of curse word, like it didn't make sense or what have you. Like, you need to read. There's a lot of books out there that validate our cause for, you know, many things, including reparations. And so this documentary, although it is done in a very creative, artistic, theatrical format, kind of circles back to this idea of this problem is a problem that is hurting not only our people, but our whole planet, our country, our citizens. Like, if this is something that, as you can see now in Palestine or Israel, that, you know, injustice is injustice everywhere, yeah. right? And so the person who actually wrote the words in my script wrote these words in 1940, right? And I'm not going to give away, that's like kind of like the punchline at the end. But this is a cycle. It's a cycle. And it's a very disgusting cycle, right? And the main problem with the cycle, right, is that generally the people who are oppressed, they don't get that it's a cycle.
Yeah.
And they think that they're just in a space by themselves and not in a space as a part of a whole group, right? And it's like, if you are able to see this thing coming, maybe we can kind of move away from it. Like, if you see a martial artist, if you see a strike coming, you can block it, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe we can block these problems by and then parry and pivot, right? And change our what our outcomes are, right? And so there's my main mission with this, is to try to create a voice or conversation around some of these pivots that are possible, including restorative justice, transformative justice, because like you said, we need to love ourselves, we need to protect ourselves, we need to police ourselves. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we need to be able to create congressional, you know, resources within, you know, our legislative pools to be able to govern ourselves.
I like how you characterize all that, because I think that, you know, with everything that has taken place from last year to this year, right, with all of the murders that we've witnessed and that we've heard of, transformative justice and restorative justice, still these like, these two concepts that people are still, I think, struggling with, right? There's still like a lack of understanding as to what this actually means. A lot of people think that when you say restorative justice or transformative justice, we're saying let's abolish the entire prison system and, you know, just... You know, and people are afraid of like what that could actually mean in terms of policing, right? So there's a lot of unanswered questions, I think, when it comes to that. But I like the fact that it's like a prong, right, within like the work that you're doing, that it's something that you're focusing on, because I think oftentimes we you know, we have individuals and we have creatives who create. And they put things out, but and there's a good cause behind it, but there's a lack of understanding and there's a lack of education with what they're hoping that people actually digest from, you know, their art. So I think that just, you know, the description of this actual production and even the way that you're talking about, you know, this, I think is really, really important for people to really grasp the main essence of the documentary.
Yeah, the to me, power to the people means making people powerful. Mm-hmm. And it's not so much helping people vote, but it's also helping people become dynamic individuals within their own communities. Mm-hmm. And that is the ultimate, the definition of restorative justice, if you ask me. One of the panelists of our celebrity panelists is Jeremy Meeks. And many people may know him as Mugshot Bay. Right. And so I had an opportunity to work with his brother. And when I tell you he's the kindest, most thoughtful person on the set that we were on, and part of that is because of his experience, right? And my brother, he did a stretch, and now he's one of the top stuntmen in the game. So these are two brothers who have the opportunity to impact the world, who have the opportunity to show positive and light, who could have been thrown away. Mm-hmm. Literally could have been thrown away. We have this false narrative that black men are black for bad fathers. Somebody asked me about what it's like to be a good father. And I said, it's an identity DNA. These are false narratives. Mm-hmm. Of course, it looks like black men are bad fathers. You got one third of us locked away. Yeah. Y'all seen 13? Yeah, there's a lot of, broken families. And I just don't buy into that. I don't believe that. I believe when you can put people in desperate situations and do desperate things. White, black, and indifferent. We just keep making these narratives around us where people want to cross the street when they see us. I had an interview with a homeless man the other day. It was like six months ago. And he just walked up to me and told me his story. I didn't even ask him to talk to me. And his whole concept was, I'm tired of my people fearing me. Why do my people fear me? I can see the white people. Why do my people fear me? And I thought that was deep. Because where is this hate for each other coming from? Yeah, of course, we got the gangs. We got this, you know, I mean, that's part of the reason my brother died from gang violence. And that's stupid in itself. But you see that it's always some manufactured BS for us to hate each other. And it's got to come from somewhere, right?
Yeah.
But if we stop it, if we say no, then there's a whole different change. And that, to me, is a part of restorative justice, allowing us to see, have those counseling, have those sessions. One of the reasons why my brother and Jeremy were able to recover in the way they have is because they were able to get mental health help. Mm-hmm. That's a big issue, especially with black men and women. Shit, I mean, you said we're not a monolith, but we're not. But we have monolithic issues.
Yeah, there are a lot of issues that.
You know, there are underlying issues for all of us. Like, you know, it was a while before I could say that, you know, I was suffering from some sort of anxiety and depression as a black man. What? Don't say that. Especially as a martial artist from, you know, the streets of Sutton Boulevard, you definitely don't say that. Yeah. Kick your teeth out. But you still have it. Yeah. And we still have to kind of find a way to navigate that. And this is our generation now. This is our duty, right? To drive the needle forward in a different way, to keep adding value. I have a friend who's getting his doctorate. And things they say, well, what are you going to add? How are you going to add value to this subject? That's what we need to do as a people in this generation, add value to those who laid the ground behind us, you know, and create more or before so that those behind us can continue to raise the bar.
Mm-hmm. So now, with your documentary, right, and just when we're talking about film in general that talks about black issues, many people might find that, you know, here we are again, capitalizing on Black trauma, right? Rehashing old wounds. And I like how in your description you stated that, you know, this film, that this is not about that. This is really about moving forward. But what about your film do you think would indicate to somebody who's watching, who has not read the description, right, to know, you know, what you said? What about your film would indicate that this is a film about moving forward? This is not just here to, you know, exploit the Black experience.
Yeah, the film itself is really directed around this idea of love. Mm-hmm. It's the underlying theme is coming together, and really, the film it goes through a day in the life, essentially, of this Melrose Avenue experience, going into, you know, your daily routine, getting a haircut, and then seeing the streets boarded up, and, you know, meeting different friends and seeing it boarded up. And these are all, like, you know, on-site locations that are, you know, real. Nothing was staged or choreographed. And then dealing with the police and then dealing with protests. But it's about coming together at the end. And that's where we change the narrative. Because a lot of times we see Black bodies being swinging from trees, right? To quote the great Billie Holiday. You know, we see, you know, all these different, like, imagery of pain, suffering. We don't see imagery of joy and jubilation, right? Yeah. And so I wanted to make sure that we focused up our, you know, that last part on that and creating this idea of, like, like, one of the greatest lines in the film to me is "Look up, look up," because to me that's what's happening now. Mm-hmm. We're looking up, right? The clouds are breaking, the sun is bright, shining through. We're coming out of the darkness into the light, into a new day, right? These are all parts of the line, of the script, and that's the moving forward part. And so my point was is that even though this is a theatrical representation. These are words that can now be tooled into saying, okay, well, how are we coming out of the lightness to the dark? This is the conversation. This is how. Restorative justice, transformative justice.
So now you also, it's, you know, in talking about moving forward, right? And I guess thinking about, like, what is the future in all of this? Yeah. You talk about a new normal. What does a new normal, or what would a new normal look like to you?
This is the biggest thing that I want for our communities, to become communities. I'm tired of neighborhoods. I'm tired of hoods. I'm tired of us slinging on blocks and calling it our own. You know how you call a block your own? You buy that motherfucker.
Yep.
That's how you call it your own. You build a mixed-use, multi-level facility, put a CVS or a Trader Joe's down there, and you play high frequency, raising frequency music in the same way that the pyramid emitted back in Pharaoh's time. We put black street signs around our neighborhood that they do in Beverly Hills where they're white to establish our communities. We put street signs in different languages like they do in Little Korea or Little Tokyo or Little Thailand. We create and establish communities that are essentially for us, by us, ran by us, governed by us, policed by us, enforced by us, and protecting our people. And that's not to say that we need to create segregated communities, but let's create hubs that we can find value from.
Yeah.
Now, listen, I'm talking very, very far, you know, far left, if you will, this altruistic utopian mindset, but that would be a great conversation to have, wouldn't it? I mean, you're talking like Pillar Mike has been discussing on a regular basis about supporting and building Black-owned establishments, Black-owned businesses, grocery stores. A lot of the brothers from the Nation of Islam have discussed this and brought this up, whether it be Wizard Islam or the Ben X. And, you know, I think this is a reason why these conversations keep happening, because this is a problem. We don't have a community. Mm-hmm. We just have different hoods that we rent, that we borrow, and that we steal for and kill for, really, with no legacy.
Yeah.
And that needs to stop today.
You know, it's interesting. I was having this conversation with somebody the other day, and I was like, you know, you don't find too many instances where this black owned business has been here for 50 years, 60 years, 70 years. Like, you don't find too many family owned generation after generation type businesses in a lot of our, you know, quote unquote communities, like you said, neighborhoods and hoods. Right. And I think, you know, the reason that a lot of times, you know, black people, we feel disrespected, we feel out of place is because we're not frequenting places that are our own. There are, we don't have our own. Like, I think one of my friends, something about, like, I think in his whole, like, town or whatever, like, there's no black owned sneaker store. Like, there's no black owned sneaker store. And we're talking about, like, urban, like in an urban area, all the sneaker stores are owned by others. They're not owned by blacks, and black people love sneakers. So it's like, you know, so I think that what you're saying is right on the nail, that we, you know, we have these hoods, we have these blocks, but we actually don't have community. And I think that that is where we need to start. We need to figure out how do we create a community?
Yeah. And, you know, one of my, you know, mentors from afar, I will say, because I never got a chance to meet the brother, but if I met him, I'd be kissing the ring, Dr. Claude Anderson and his book, Powernomics. And one of the things he talks about first and foremost is love amongst the community, horizontal integration, into vertical integration, integrating churches. These are all steps that will help us create and establish community, creating some sort of actual visual, like I said, with the black street signs that establishes where the community's boundaries are. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily like you don't have to have like a roadblock or anything, but it's just so that you know when you drive in Beverly Hills, these white street signs let you know this is not the area of other people. This is the white street sign people. We'll just put it that way. You know what I'm saying? So, but you had mentioned something before, and I wanted to address it. It totally skipped my mind. But the businesses, right? So you don't see a lot of black businesses that have been around for 40 years, 30 years. But what you do see, this is what you rarely see, even rarely than that. And this is where we really got to get to. It's not so much having a mom and pop shop that lasted 40, 50 years. That's what my father has. My father has fought martial arts school, been there since the 75. So before I was even born. Mm-hmm. So that's about 40, 45 years. But it's not changed. We haven't been able to elevate that, mm-hmm, and scale that and make that into a full-on multinational corporation. That's how true. Many of those have you seen? You see, we've got to get out of the idea of like, now we do have to crawl before we walk, before we run, before we fly, right? So I'm not saying that we have to skip steps, but we have to keep mindset of, you know, Chinese think 300 years in the future. That's how they plan.
Yeah.
We need to start thinking like that. You know, let's build pyramids that we know will be done two lifetimes away, but we start now. Yeah. And so I think we're too narrow-minded. We're too nearsighted. Mm-hmm. We got to get the hustle. And that's not really a fault of our own. That's part of the PTSD of trying to survive, of living paycheck to paycheck, of being in an environment where your rent is literally 7/8 of your check. And you're on government subsidized funding that you only can get if you kick the daddy out of the house.
Yeah.
Big problem. So, I mean, these are systematic problems. We get it. But now let's see if we can break some of these chains by being entrepreneurial, by bringing back wealth to these communities in a way that is fundamentally improving these communities by, you know, demilitarizing the police. You don't necessarily defund them, but we don't need to have, you know, big, you know, and this is not even nice to say, but like, because I feel like these brothers in these indigenous countries like Arabia and stuff are being kind of persecuted in our way. But like, I mean, you got Desert Storm attire in our police officers.
Yeah.
So are we insurgents in our own land? Because I don't see this in, you know, in these other communities like Bel Air and, you know,
not there.
Right. So there's that notion of us building businesses, but now let's scale these businesses. Let's develop enterprises.
Yeah.
Let's build, you know, I have seen a lot of beautiful cities. I don't know any city that I've been in, from New York to California to Shanghai to Paris to Rome, where there is a 22, 24 story tower building that's owned and run by a black conglomerate. Not one. And every other city has something that's Korean, Chinese, mm-hmm, Japanese, and of course white, Jewish, You know, where's ours? How is that possible?
Yeah, that's true. That is true. That's a lot to think about. And I think that, you know, again, with having these conversations, you know, hopefully it'll spark that interest right. in people to say, you know what, like what he said was right. Like I've never seen that before. And I think, you know, when you're talking about scaling, that actually really hit me hard because I'm like, yeah, we do focus so much on, you know, well, we got to get Black businesses. We got to do this with businesses, but we don't talk about what's next. How do we scale? How do we get that, you know, multi-level corporation and that conglomerate? I think these are very important topics if we're talking about building, like the true building of generational wealth.
Right. Like let's think 300 years in advance.
Yeah. Yeah.
What does that look like?
So now I want to touch on that a little bit because, you know, again, just another part of the narrative description that you put forth with respect to this documentary is that, you know, we wanna talk about the new normal. We wanna see a new normal, but then we also want to work together, right? And find ways to avoid self-destruction. But a lot of times people, you know, when they think about being collective with one another within these communities of color, there's this negative mantra that, well, Black people or people of color, we don't work together. We don't work well together. We don't support each other. Like there's all this negativity about collaboration. But in order for us to get to this new normal, this new era, this new way of living, this better way of living, we have to work together. But I guess what do you find fuels this negativity, like this like negative mantra where it's not white people saying it, but Black people that are saying we don't work well together?
This is remember when I told you that, you know, some of these other cultures are thinking 300 years in advance? This is the exact plan for Willie Lynch. This is what he wanted. You got to understand. So this was a system. This was a process. The idea of race was because, as I quote Dr. Claude in his book, was because it was a race to get Black people over here the fastest so they can get their land built up faster so they can claim it for themselves. That's what the race was. The race was to get us. That's why it's called racist. This whole idea of white superiority and Black superiority was created in Virginia. These are systems, programs. That's what these television shows us, mm-hmm. right? Think about who owns the news.
Yeah.
So if you're told that you're trash every day, that you can't trust the person you live with every day, then you're going to believe it. It's the same thing I said about how you tell a Black man to be a better father. He was already a great father. Mm-hmm. It's in his DNA. We already love each other. You understand where we come from. See, then this is part of the reason why we're different. You know, and that's why they say certain people are, you know, are not ethical or non-human. I don't necessarily, you know, I don't want to get into that narrative. But I think that's also a false narrative. It's when you start to project others into a negative or deteriorative state, it only just reflects your inferiority or your insecurity. That's my belief. Mm-hmm. Because we're all descendants, or we all are a problem from the one source. Right, so you have divinity in you, even, or you know, even the most insane, brave person has divinity in them. And it, trust me, it doesn't mean that I'm not, you know, come in peace, take you to pieces kind of person. I'm still a martial artist, so I defend myself and I defend my family. That's not what I'm saying. I'm not just some sort of like, you know, everybody love everybody. We should, but we do have to protect ourselves. With that said, I believe that us from our diaspora, from people of color, people from indigenous lands, had so much abundance. Had so much wealth. We had abundance for water, abundance for food, pure, clean air. We had resources, animals who we cohabitated with. That when someone who didn't have saw what we had, it was easy for them to take it because they saw value and they basically manipulated themselves into taking that. So what I'm saying is this: we come from a space where we were wonderful, accepting, and loving toward each other. That was the narrative. This is a false narrative. And we have thousands and thousands of years of working together, of building monumental, you know, earth-changing architecture that you can't get rid of this on this planet to this day. It's still there. I mean, not to mention the pyramids, but you've seen the churches in Ethiopia. I mean, things that are created were just incredible. Mm-hmm. right? I don't know any pyramids in Europe. Do you?
No.
I don't know why, but I mean, I don't know. I haven't seen them. Maybe then you just haven't found them yet. But I, you know, the point is, is that we work together at such a great scale. And history cannot deny it.
Yeah.
So what I would say to that is trust your instincts, because when you think about it, you don't really hate your brother. You don't really hate your sister. You don't really want to kill or steal. You are just desperate.
Yeah.
And so this is the PTSD kicking. This is the, when a cop pulls us over, hands are out the window before anything happens, because we just are instinctively worried about what could happen. And it's okay, because guess what? Having a mental health concern or having some sort of mental health issue around being beaten and abused, as you mentioned, you had did a piece on domestic violence and abuse. You tell people, You're not to blame for that, mm-hmm. and you can feel okay about expressing some sort of guilt and pain from that. But we have to move forward and process that. And that's the same trauma. We are domestically abused people. Think about that. We are the domestic violence recipient of the world, or at least of this country. And I would venture to say the world too, because you can go to other countries and get treated pretty poorly.
Yeah,
and so we have to process that. And there's no one better that can process that than us. And I know I've seen a lot of these young artists, young actors, rappers, they don't come from that space of hate the same way that that's perpetuated in, you know, in some of the music, some of the narratives, you know, even in some of the films that I've been a part of. We're acting in a way that we know the quote unquote status quo wants to see us act, but that's not really who we are. And so we have to kind of dig deeper, and it's happening. Mm-hmm. People are starting to reveal their true self. So you see rappers who are quote unquote gangster rappers or rapping about violence, but on their really everyday life, they're not. They're actually talking about empowerment. You know, you got guys like Rick Ross who talks about gangster stuff all the time, mm-hmm. but then you listen to him more and you're like, this brother's actually trying to empower his people. Mm-hmm. You know, he's talking about building back, you know, blocks and creating value through, you know, investments and whatnot. And it's okay, yeah, no, we just got to get past that. Meek Mill, Jay-Z, you know, all these guys who are creating value while still kind of creating a narrative because they got to sell records, which is unfortunate. But let those people buy those records. We continue to keep supporting, you know, the craft, but we have to dig that and see the science behind it. And I think now more than ever, we're starting to see that. And, you know, the other thing is, too, we just have to start to pull our money together. You know, because really, resources, and it's funny because money to me doesn't exist. Like, I could be a trillionaire right now. There's nothing I can do with it right now. Nothing. I mean, we're still having the same conversation. I've seen multi-millionaires and very, very high-profile billionaire people, and they have the same setups. You know what I'm saying? The same ring lights. It's like, you know.
You hear that, everyone? You hear that? I'm on par with the multi-millionaires.
Like, listen, I mean, we get this in our minds that, oh, you know, this whole lifestyle is completely different. Money is an illusion, right? It's just something to get us to think of something. It's to get us into a race. We have to focus on the, like I said before, the objective, the why. But to focus on, you know, the legacy we want to leave, and then all that money and resources will come, right? Because we're providing value. For me, the idea of providing value makes you valuable, and thus deems you worthy of valuables, right? So I guess before I get off into this more of the soapbox tangent, I think to answer your question very specifically, we have to love ourselves enough to forgive ourselves, and we have to basically support ourselves. Not just by like giving us fish, but support ourselves by creating facilities and creating, you know, centers, if you will, that will allow us to develop. And that's where, you know, this money is going towards those type of organizations that are helping to develop, helping to pivot kids out of these, you know, prison systems and these thrown away facilities like penitentiaries. I call them throwaways, where they just try to throw us away and hide us. And they can't keep doing that because we can't be hidden anymore. It ain't gonna happen. It ain't gonna keep happening because the power is in the people. No matter how hard you try to suppress the voice, you can't. You can't hide the truth.
You know, it's interesting when you talk about the voice being, you know, that voice, that power being innate. The other day I had posted something on our Instagram feed of a little girl in Haiti that she might have been 7 or 8, but she was reciting a poem about solidarity.
Yeah, I think I've seen that.
Yeah. And I was like, I'm looking at this young child, like she had to be like maybe 7 or 8, could not be older than that. And the power, the fervor that was in her voice talking about the injustices of what was happening in her country, what she was seeing. The title of it was Nubuke, which means we're tired. But to see like the fight in this little child. And so when you said this, you know, that you know, our voices cannot be silenced. The power is within. That's what that reminded me of, that even as children, you see these children now who are taking up the mantle. And I think that if we understood, I guess, as a people, that the power truly is within us, like we would, you know, we'd be able to do more. We'd be able to do better.
And we're getting there, like you said. I think the younger generation, the you know, maybe not as young as 9, but the 15 to 24, 25 year olds are becoming a little bit more cognizant of their role. I mean, think about being 21 years old. You just came off of a crazy presidency. You got riots, you got pandemics, you got the pollution in the world, you got cats trying to escape and go to Mars. You're like, what the hell am I going? What am I getting myself into as an adult? Like, I don't even know if I'm going to college. So I think there's a certain sense of a social responsibility that is starting to seep into our younger generation. And these are the ones that are kind of being influenced by, you know, our generation. And, you know, I think that it's our duty to continue to shed light so that we can continue to pass the mantle. And, you know, you're going to have kids much younger than us start to kind of, you know, eloquently recite their opinions. And it's going to be completely different than what the status quo wants it to be, because we're not going to continue to be programmed like we're dumb, deaf, and blind, because, you know, verily is verily, truth is truth, and it's innate. You know, my I didn't get a book that told me how to be a dad. That's why I said trust your instincts in your DNA. Right? It's not in our DNA to hurt each other. It's not in our DNA to be suppressed by drugs and violence and hypocritical beliefs of religion and falsehoods. Right? So it's not in our makeup. So that'll eventually seep through, even though we went through a lot of bad generations or generations that didn't necessarily have the same amount of resources that we have as far as information, they still were making great adjustments, right? I mean, my father's a child of the 70s and 60s, and I'm in awe what those brothers did. You know, you look at Judas and Black Messiah. I read Seize the Time of Bobby Seale. I mean, these are impactful, very powerful brothers. Bobby Seale was one of the founders of the Black Panther Party, along with Huey P. Newton, the Minister of Justice, Minister of Defense, excuse me. You know, we're going to keep leveling up. You can't stop.
Yeah.
No one can stop. No bomb, no plague, no one can stop.
Yeah. We are truly an interesting people. We're truly a resilient group. And I think that, like you said, like we've already seen strides, and we're only going to get, I think as more and more people are starting to awaken, it's only going to strengthen, I think, the movement, right?
It's funny you said awaken. Awaken from what?
I think for me, there's different forms of the awakening, right? I think that there's a level of ignorance that some of it's willful. Some of it is by design because of the structuring of this country. But I focus more so on the willful ignorance that a lot of, unfortunately, I feel like our people live just, ignorance is bliss. That's there's this concept of ignorance being bliss. And I think that that has kept a lot of us from doing what needed to be done within our neighborhoods to create these communities. I think it's prevented us from empowering not only ourselves, but others. But I think that we're starting to get to a place where people are realizing that this world, or this illusion called America, like these things that we thought were, I guess, I don't know, inclusive of us or whatever it was, that this paradise that we, this utopic, I don't know, like all the names that I could think about what America has represented for a lot of people is not real. And that we have to
stick together as whether it be Black people, people of color, whatever the terminology people want to use. We actually do need each other. Like, we can't rely on this fake system. It's not real. I think that people are starting to wake, like they're starting to be okay pulling away from whatever these luxuries and again, this willful ignorance that they were living in for God knows how many years. So that for me, that's the awakening that I'm starting to see, that people are not, they're not caring about what they cared about before, like the materialism and all this other stuff. They're starting to see that this is a real fight. We got to move forward and we got to do it together. And we got to put, you know.
I love it. I mean, I couldn't have said it better myself. I was just curious. And I think to just maybe even piggyback off of that, you know, the willful ignorance is the great grand plan, right? The Matrix, if you will, which is ironic that a Matrix was written and directed or created by a Black one, right? Because that's essentially what we are in as Black people in this country. It is a Matrix, it's a construct, you know, some sort of false reality. And, you know, one of the greatest ways of, you know, creating a happy livestock and a full meal for, you know, the farmer is to just feed them, keep them fed, keep them fed with whatever they think they need, whatever they think they want, not what's best for them. You don't empower them. You ultimately dumb them down and feed them and then take them to the slaughterhouse, and they willingly will go because ultimately they trust you. Mm-hmm. You build their trust by feeding them. And I think that's kind of what's happening in a very, you know, rudimentary kind of way of putting it to our people. And, the awakening, you said, is really about putting in the work. I think people are starting to say, you know what, I'm going to start buying sustainable clothing, not buy this fast fashion bullshit. Or I'm going to start filtering my water and not buying a bunch of cups and, you know, plastic bottles. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I get disappointed sometimes when I see our people like do a lot of like I'm in Baltimore. There's a Chick-fil-A like a block and a half, and every day it is like trash all over the place. And I just get so disappointed by that. And I think a lot of that comes from because we live in communities of potholes and boarded windows and stuff like that. So we trash our neighborhoods. Moreover, we only have like 25-cent grenade sodas and Newport cigarettes on every playground. These are things that kind of continue to help us grow, right? Seeing these things correctly, making these self-corrections. But yeah, it's happening.
Yeah.
It's happening. And I'm for one with you, sister, going to continue to perpetuate and make it happen.
And I think that this documentary is definitely another step in that direction, right? I think art is becoming, I mean, it's always been, but I feel like people are coming out of that. I don't know if it's the pandemic, but the creative juices are flowing and people are, you know, figuring out that you can be powerful through art. You can convey, you know, messages through art. And I'm seeing more of that. And I want to just make sure that we, you know, we get the details of this documentary out so that people, because I know people are like, you keep talking about this documentary. Where can I find it? How can I support the project? So where can people tune in or I guess to the premiere, or where can they access this documentary?
Yeah. So I try to make it as simple as possible. The website is watchnkw.com. So it's NKW. I'm teaching my daughter sign language and I try to do everything but the middle thing. So, sign language and Swahili, actually.
Oh, nice.
But and Arabic too. But we're at watchnkw.com, May 25th. 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 6 p.m. Central Standard, Pacific Standard Time. The film is going to have a live premiere. And what's going to be cool about this premiere is that we're going to have Claudia Jordan, who's the host of Fox Soul, out loud with Fox Soul. She's going to host the event. We're going to have a, you know, kind of an introductory piece as to, you know, who I am, why I decided to do this. We're going to show the film. And then we're going to have a celebrity panel. We're going to have people like Jeremy Meeks, who's, you know, a very high-profile celebrity individual who experienced life behind bars and has changed his life around. He's an actor now, and as well as a model. And I've worked with him on a project, actually two films. And then we'll have Jazz Lewis, who's a delegate from Maryland and from the 34th District. He's been doing a lot of work on restorative justice. And, you know, I wanted to get some money from the political side of things. Mm-hmm. So we have a bunch of other panelists coming on board to really kind of talk about how this issue can really help impact and change the lives of our future. So it's going to be a full-on event. The documentary is about, it's a short documentary, right? So it's only about like 10, 15 minutes long. But it's a powerful punch in a short amount of time. And then after that, if you happen to miss it, we're going to be submitting to a lot of film festivals. So just keep your ears and eyes open for the film festival circuit. Once we get past the film festival run, then, you know, God willing, we'll get some distribution and, you know, we'll be able to get on some of these online platforms. But we're still in the early ages of the distribution right now. So if you really want to see this film, you got to get in. You got to get it while you can get in on Tuesday, May 25th. Now, one cool thing that we're also going to do. Now, I'm a filmmaker. I'm an actor. I deal with the visual medium, but also recognize the value of just the audio. Right? This could be, you could be hearing this only on audio and not seeing me. So
nice.
We decided to take advantage of that, and we're going to simulcast our premiere on Clubhouse. So if you've been unable to see it, you'll be able to access it on Clubhouse, and you'll be able to access that for free.
Okay.
So you'll be at least be able to hear, you know, what's going on in the space, and then obviously hear our panel as well.
And although I am not a representative of Apple by any means necessary, but this is where having an iPhone would be important, right? So you can get on. There's always these iPhone Android wars, but I'm like, Clubhouse is for iPhone only. So,
well, you know what? I didn't think about that. We'll have to do something special for you Android guys, I guess.
Gotta figure something out.
Hey, listen, if you're an Android user, you gotta bite the bullet about it.
You have to dust off the old iPad.
You know what I'm saying? Look, you guys are saving some money on the top end with the iPhone getting the Android. So you just do some of that throwback to the good people of the nonprofit. No, it's all good. Pay it forward.
So now I know you stated that some of the proceeds from this event is going to go through some nonprofit organizations. Are you at liberty to give us maybe a couple of names?
Yeah, I'd love to. So one of my my really cool, I know him through one of my best friends. She's with the director of this establishment, but I think he's so cool. His name is Dr. Harry Grammer. And he established a place called New Earth Life that was newearthlife.org is the website if you guys are looking for it. But it's essentially, it started off as an arts program where he started off as a poet. He was a homeless man, and he started to kind of recognize some of the, you know, disparities in his life and changed them through his poetry. Mm-hmm. And he decided to allow that to be something that he would use as a catapult to help, or catalyst to help others, including many who was primarily youth. And in a short time frame, I mean, less than 5-10 years, he's become a multi-million dollar charity that's driving kids from Inglewood, Compton, and South Central away from prison systems. Mm-hmm. They have a beautiful facility in Culver City. They're expanding to essentially like a camp. They're taking a old prison and turning it into a camp in Northern California, or I would say the Valley of California, obviously Northern LA, I should say. And, you know, I really want to help them do that. I really want to help them, you know, feed their kids when they have these camping trips where they go into the mountains. And, you know, they actually have a documentary of one of their kids on HBO's documentary, Foster, who one of the kids that was on there, that's part of their program, was adopted by Sia, of all people. And, you know, I think, you know, organizations like that, you know, they really need company, or they need, like, you know, more attention from the media. I mean, the gentleman was an Obama fellow, so he's already has a nice following, and he has a good buzz going already. But, you know, the more eyes on organizations like that, the better. I also mentioned that my father was a martial artist, and he basically created his platform in South Jamaica Queens. And he's going to actually be a part of the panel as well.
Nice.
And I thought it was important to have his perspective because he comes from the perspective of a martial artist, but he's also an OG. You know, he actually did, you know, a segment of time behind bars, and that changed his life. He pulled out in the way that Malcolm X did, where he converted to Islam in prison. And that's how I have my name. So his name is originally Barry Jackson. And so, you know, as he continued to learn himself, learn his worth, realized that he wasn't Jack's son, and he changed his last name to Mutakabir. And so I'm born Muslim, born Mutakabir, because of his inspiration and his heroic effort to change his lifestyle. You know, I wouldn't be here if you didn't. So these are conversations that I want to drive forward. And these individuals, Dr. Harry Grandma, C.J. Abdullah, Dr. Beer, and many others we're going to include soon as well, to become, you know, highlighted and showcased, because it's not about the artist, it's about the art, right? Yeah. And that's important.
All right. All right. So now I love plugging people. So I know that you know, this film is actually being produced by your production company. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
Kinsman Studio.
Yep. Yep.
All right.
We're all kin. All
right. So what other projects do you have in the pipeline for Kinsman Studios?
Thank you. Thank you for that question. So I'm actually in pre-production for a feature we're working on with a couple of other local producers. We're getting some tax credits from the Baltimore Film Commission right now. But it's going to be called, it's essentially called Hamza. It's called Brother Ninja, The Lion in the Desert. And the idea is about a, think The Last Dragon meets The Equalizer set in The Wire.
Interesting.
And I'm kind of bringing back old school martial arts, old school stuff. It's a redemption story. It's a love story. But more importantly, it's a story about fighting for the community. One of the things that I'm going to be doing a lot more with Kinsman Studios is producing films and content. I also have a documentary called Our Legacy Complex, which basically talks about the complexities of building a legacy as a Black man in America. Most of the projects that I'm anticipating on producing and creating are going to be surrounding, you know, Black Indigenous people of color, Black Americans, and how we can create we have another story, another side. As I mentioned before, and as you highlighted, my stories aren't about having some sort of capitalization on Black trauma. I'm not trying to perpetuate, you know, this narrative of, you know, a Stringer Bell as being the only successful Black man in the community. I want to create a narrative that's around, you know, heroism, that's around strong legacy, dynamics, love, and even, you know, stories of old. So I'm excited about some of the projects that we have going up. I'm also working with HGTV, and this is another, like, kind of like getting a little ahead of myself. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm optimistic, but we're cautiously close to a deal where we're creating a kind of a flipping show in Baltimore.
Oh, wow.
While I'm building the block back. So I'm excited. A lot of the projects that I'm working on are going to be as, you know, positive and as, you know, just creating or redirecting the narrative when it comes to our culture.
I love it. I love it. You're speaking my language there.
Well, we'll have some content for you soon then.
Yes, definitely. I'm all about, you know, cross promoting, especially if it's, you know, on brand.
Yeah.
It seems like everything you do is essentially on brand with what we do. So we'll definitely be reaching out. So
yeah, we'll definitely. I mean, and then we're going to keep continuing to cross with others and continue to keep building, because this is a web and, you know, mm-hmm. The more we have, the stronger. Like, I always equate it to a table, right? I think that's why it's important for us to be able to support ourselves and produce, right? The more legs you have on our table, the less the table can collapse. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to have as many people in our voices, collaborative voices together, and to be strong and support each other as much as possible so that we can create a strong table.
No, of course.
Yeah.
So now people are probably like, where can I know where I can get you know, the premiere of the film, but how do I connect with this gentleman? How can I follow him? How can I figure out, you know, what he's up to next? So could you drop us all of your social media handles, websites?
Thank you for that as well. So I'm going to shamelessly plug my film again, watchnkw.com. I want you guys to go there first and get your ticket right now.
Now.
So. All right. So do that on the other phone or your laptop. While you're watching this, though, I'm going to tell you my other stuff. It's my IG is simple. It's King_Yumba, YUMBA. If you follow me there, you'll find my links to some other stuff in my link tree. If you're looking for my website and some of the work that I've done, and you're just, you know, curious about, you know, if you have a film or you want me to help you with something, you know, in regards to mental health, I also do coaching. You can find me at KinyumbaMutakaBeer.com. if you just put in Kinyumba and Google, you'll find the rest of it. It's pretty, I'm Googleable. What can I say?
It's a good quality to have these days.
You know, I told my dad, I said, you gave me this daggone name, I can never rob a bank, bro. Appreciate you.
He knew what he was doing. He was keeping you out of trouble.
From yeah, it's like, you can't do nothing wrong. Like, everybody knows this guy. He's got 22 letters in his name. And then as far as the mental wellness, if you're interested in that piece as well, it's momentsofalignment.com. Moments of Alignment is my company. I believe that we can align with our highest divine self by going within. The journey within helps us get out. I use martial arts practices. I use NLP. I use Reiki to help create a different narrative, which is why you'll see a lot of these concepts in my films. Mm-hmm. Outside of that, you know, if you want, again, I'm on Twitter, Mr_Mutaka_Beer, and then of Clubhouse, I'm King Yumba as well, KingYumba.
All right. Well, I mean, this was such a dynamic conversation. I think that we touched on so much. And I, you know, again, everyone, you know, this is a young man who is doing his thing for the community. And we need to support. We need to support. We must support. And so definitely head on over to the website and get your ticket now so that we can all be enjoying and tweeting and discussing the premiere of this film. But I just wanted to tell you again, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about not just your film, but just to really get into a real conversation about like the issues that we're experiencing as people of color and how we can go about finding solutions and really talking about the hope for the future.
Well, like I said before, my sister, it was an incredible honor. I'm humbled by you giving me a platform to have this conversation. You know, thank you for your listeners who have been able to, you know, sit and enjoy this for this long. I appreciate you all, and you know, and a forward thank you for those who are going to be attending the feature or the short film documentary. We look forward to seeing you there, and let's continue to keep having these conversations. Let this be our last time having this conversation. Let's circle back in a few months and see where things are for each other. And, you know, be accountable. One of the things I'm big on is holding each other accountable.
Yes.
And, you know, it's following through. And like I said before, we can talk a lot, but we have to act too. So if you're listening and you're looking to act, you know, there are links to those nonprofits on that website. You know, you can get involved in your community. You can look up restorative justice programs in your area. You can Google. You can do things on a higher caliber as far as what you're doing on a daily basis, as far as, you know, recycling, buying sustainable clothing, you know, even going in a different lifestyle as far as your diet. We all have to put our hands on deck, you know, and I would challenge every person out there. So I'll leave you with this. If you're a person of color, if you see another person of color, if you're a black person, you see another black person, I challenge you to smile and say hello. What's up?
That is a challenge for many. So that's not a light ask for a lot.
It's not a light ask. And I think that's part of the change in the narrative.
Right? Yeah.
Just smile. You'd be surprised what you get back from a smile.
I like that a lot. All right, everyone. Well, thank you so much for tuning into another episode of According to RP on WJMS Radio, powered by Black Ivy Media. It's your girl, Rita Pierre, your host. And as always, I will talk to you guys next week.
You were listening to According to RP on WJMS Radio.
About time you tuned in.
Tune in each and every Sunday.
I can't wait to come back.
7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
It's all online.
WJMSradio.com.
Download the new app.
Live 365. Listen to the show and